You're listening to 95.7 FM, KDRT LP, Davis, California.
I see trees of green, red roses too. I see them bloom for me and you. And I think to myself, what a wonderful world. I see skies of blue and clouds of white, the bright blessed day, the dark sacred night. And I think to myself, what a wonderful world.
And that music means it's time for the Davis Garden Show. This is Don Shore.
And this is Lois Richter on a bright, beautiful, sunny Davis day. Oh, Don, I get to say that. I'm so happy.
Apparently, you get to say it all the way through to next Tuesday. Today's date is April 29, 2026, as Lois and I are preparing the show for broadcast on April 30, last day of April 2026. And I just see mostly clear, mostly sunny, all the way through to Tuesday, where there's a slight chance of rain. So finally, some warming trend here in the Sacramento Valley. All right, we're not complaining too much about the temperatures we've had, but the nights have been in the low to mid 40s, and the days have barely been breaking into the low 70s for the last few days. And we all want to get out there and plant our summer vegetables. Today, April 29th, will be 79 degrees. Tonight will be 49 degrees and clear. Thursday, 83 degrees and sunny. Thursday night, 53 degrees and mostly clear, and that's the temperature range we're looking for. Friday is 83 degrees and sunny. Friday night is 54 degrees, partly cloudy. Saturday, 78 degrees, mostly sunny. What we're looking at is temperatures in the upper 70s to low 80s with nights in the low 50s. It does appear that after Tuesday, we'll drop down a little bit. Let's see, Monday, Tuesday. Monday will be 68. It'll only be 50 at night. Tuesday will be 72, 51. By the way, Weather Underground is not calling for rain next week. Thursday will be 80, 53 at night. Friday will be 83, 54 at night. Those are summer vegetable temperatures. That's what we've been waiting for, to see that soil temperature bump up and stay consistent. Obviously, lots of people are planting vegetables and flowers when they have the time. Well, we've reached that point where, yeah, it's cooler than we prefer, but go ahead and do it if this is the weekend you've got, kind of thing. Tomatoes that are going in the ground are stalling and then gradually greening back up and beginning to put on some new growth. We'll get to more of that, of course, this week and next week as we talk about what you should do when you're planting and the soil is colder. Little tricks you can take to enhance those little baby vegetables and get them along. We had problems last year with a cool spell at the time of planting, is my recollection. And of course, last year we had dry soil, so a lot of plants just sat and really didn't get off to a good start. This year we had a good inch of rain a few days ago, so at least the soil has some hydration. But the nights have been colder and the soil temperatures have been colder. So some of the things that people are putting in, we're getting the pictures, having the conversations. I put these peppers in 2 weeks ago and they haven't done anything. Well, I'm not surprised. 2 weeks ago, soil temperatures were too cold for peppers to go in here in the Sacramento Valley. But we've got some nice weather coming up this week. And of course, it's the month of May. And as one lady put it, I'm just running out of calendar. It was about a week ago. You know, it's kind of cold. We're a little concerned about this. She goes, yeah, but this is the weekend I have to do it. You know what? Go for it. It's not like back in March when you were planting and we were waving flags and saying, no, don't do this yet. It's way too early. At this point, it's just, yeah, hope for the best. We've got a couple announcements to get to. You have one in front of you there.
I actually have two, because I found another one while you were talking about the weather. And that is, this UC Davis Bee Haven is going to be having two events this weekend. Saturday, May 2nd, will be a nature journaling event, and this is for young, for adults. And then for the young folks, for kindergarten age through fifth, will be on Sunday, May 3rd. Both of those are at the UC Davis Bee Haven on Bee Biology Road. The Raptor Center is having their open house on May 2nd, that's Saturday. And this is from 9 a.m. to 3 p.m. The address is 1340 Equine Lane, California Raptor Center.
Yep. And the annual.
And you had one, didn't you, Don?
The annual Pence Gallery Garden Tour is Sunday, May 3rd from noon to 5 p.m. Tickets are available online. Buy ahead of time, you'll save a little money, and they do sell them. We sell them at the Redwood Barn. They sell them at Pence Gallery and so forth. There are going to be five gardens spread around Davis on the Pence Gallery Garden Tour. These are beautiful local gardens. There will be local artists in the gardens painting outdoors. There will be master gardeners answering questions at some or all of them. And at the Pence itself, which is hosting a reception that day, you can enjoy three stunning art exhibits by regional artists. And I'm proud to say that Tree Davis Grove out in West Davis is one of the stops on the garden tour this year, the Legacy Grove out on Shasta Drive. So lots of great gardens, lots of great ideas. You can buy tickets online, or you can go to Redwood Barn Nursery, Pence Gallery, and even the day of the sale. Hey, you better head over to Pence for that, because we hand them all back the day before the sale, anything that hasn't sold. So you head over there on the day of the sale. But you zoom around, you look at these amazing gardens, the annual Pence Gallery Garden Tour, Sunday, May 3rd, 2026, noon to 5 p.m.
Well, it is our last show in April.
Correct.
My goodness, this year has gone fast.
It's been a weird spring, let me tell you. That's all I can say. Weird in every regard.
So I was looking at the April calendar, preparing to get the May calendar up, and I realized that there's a flower on there that we didn't talk about, and I'm not quite sure about. It's the picture on the 16th of April, and it says bluebells. Is that a campanula? All it shows is the flowers, and I can't quite tell.
That is a bluebell, which is a type of bulb in the genus Scilla.
Scilla.
Originally, then moved to Hyacinthoides. And now, at least in the current, most recent edition of the Sunset Western Garden Book, Endymion, E-N-D-Y-M-I-O-N, which is a lovely name.
Just call them the face.
There's generally very good reasons for the name changes, but they're obscure. So I don't know why they moved it to Endymion, probably because of precedence, which is one of the more common reasons for a name change, that, hey, look, somebody had already named this 100 years before. Okay, well, precedence always prevails in taxonomy. You can call
except
it
for DNA. They change it for DNA.
Well, there's been molecular research, as they call it, which has established better understanding of the relationships of certain plants, and there have been some wholesale taxonomic revisions of particular groups of plants based on that. This change goes back many years before they were doing the kind of molecular analysis I was just talking about. Mostly it's just recognizing that the relationship was either stronger or weaker, or that there was a previous name that has precedence. You can call it Scilla if you wish. You can call it Hyacinthoides. I kind of liked that one because oides means Leica, and hyacinth is a hyacinth. So Hyacinthoides said, hey, this is Leica hyacinth.
What's the species name, Don?
The species, well, it depends on which one you're looking at. This particular one is the English bluebell, which is now Endymion non scriptus. I knew it as Scilla campanulata.
So we got Hyacinthoides campanulata. It looks like a hyacinth. It looks like a campanula.
Yeah, there you go. So take all those and mash them together, and you have an incredibly easy bulb to grow.
We'll just call it bluebells.
Well, bluebells, wood hyacinth, English hyacinth, Spanish bluebells. Now, it happens that one of these, the Spanish bluebells, although they describe it as the most widely planted, I am told that that one is pretty invasive up in the Pacific Northwest. It does spread lightly in gardens here, but much more commonly sold, at least that we've sold through our nursery, is the English hyacinth, now Endymion non scriptus, formerly Scilla campanulata. And my planting of this plant, I put in a few bulbs well over 30 years ago in one spot. And in that spot, two or three dozen plants come up each spring, give me this lovely pale blue flower, and it lasts for 2 weeks, 3 weeks. The plant goes to seed a little bit and then dies down completely, just disappears. And it has increased in its location, but it hasn't spread from its location. So the seeds don't appear to be a problem, at least for me. And my experience with English bluebells is they aren't particularly even a garden thug, much less truly invasive. Spanish bluebells apparently can become invasive. Mine are in complete shade all the time. They started out in the sun a long time ago, but as often happens on my property, well, you know, trees got planted.
Trees grow, like, yeah.
They do, yes, they have a way of doing that. So it's now under the shade of a Japanese maple, which itself is under the shade of a sycamore tree, and they do fine right there at the base. They pop up and kind of startle me every year with this brief bloom, and then that's it. And they have been slowly increasing. So to me, English bluebells or wood hyacinths are a very well-mannered bulb, but I do understand people might be listening in places where it rains more, where the bulbs could increase more freely. At least the Spanish bluebell, I'm told, can be kind of invasive and they're really hard to tell apart. Here in California, go for it. These are wonderful bulbs, bright or pale blue flowers in the spring for a brief period, pretty early. I did take this picture in April, but I've had them blooming some years as early as late March.
So we've got the naked ladies.
Yep.
And that is they like dry soil.
They can
like
tolerate. Well, let's not generalize too much. You're talking about Amaryllis belladonna.
Yeah.
And we planted some on this property when we first moved here. My mom brought us a sack load of them. And we did this thing that where we walked around and tossed a couple bulbs somewhere and then planted them there. Just basically all around the house, all around the different places that were going to be garden beds, we put a couple bulbs in. Some of those areas have become complete and total shade. Some of them have been full sun but irrigated. Many of them have been full sun but unirrigated. And you know what? They do equally well in all of those settings. So my experience with Amaryllis belladonna, the naked lady, is that it comes back in almost any situation here. And that sun to at least light shade seems to be fine. And I have them blooming even in what I would consider to be considerable shade. It can tolerate total drought once established.
And naked ladies are a fall blooming bulb.
August. So yeah, whatever that is.
They have the leaves in the spring and then the leaves die down and then the stalk comes up with the flower and the surprise in the fall.
Usually my first pictures are taken in late July. They bloom in early to mid-August. So I guess really technically summer bloomers, and the bloom hangs on into September. And it's one of these things that you kind of forget about, and there they are and they pop up out of nowhere. Hence the name naked ladies. There's a couple others that do that. Rain lily. Like Horus, there's other bulbs that follow that same pattern. And once you've planted them, they're carefree. You really don't have to do anything. Many people have bulbs that will give a long sequence of bloom. The key is to figure out what they're going to do after the bloom. So for example, paper white narcissus, you know, if you happen to like them, they bloom early. That's great. The fragrance, some people really love it.
And they look a little.
And you have 3 months of this massive foliage growth and there's a little chaotic. To me, Amaryllis belladonna, naked ladies, have a foliage that's reasonably attractive. I'm looking out the window. There's a big clump of them out there. They look fine. And the one we started this conversation with, the wood hyacinth, English hyacinth, completely gone. As soon as they're done blooming, the foliage dies down. There's nothing there until next February.
All right. So that was the April calendar. We'll look at the May calendar some other week, but not this week. But I really wanted to highlight something that I just saw flowering this week. And that is, it's a bush. It has flowers that are bigger than your hand and white flat petals making a circle, kind of crinkly, like crepe paper or something. And then right in the middle, there is a half globe of yellow, bright yellow. And that's got pollen all over it. It's so cute.
You mean the thing that
it
looks like a fried egg?
Fried egg flower. Yes. Romnia. It's really called Matilaha poppy.
It's really called Romnia culturae, if you want to use the botanical term. Matilaha poppy is the common name. I love the Western Garden Book description that it responds to water, tolerates aridity. So this is native to Southern California and Baja. It grows on hillsides down there where it gets 3 feet, 4 feet. And so people here will plant it. And they look like floating fried eggs. I mean, they are giant flowers. And there's a whole bunch of them up, as with many poppies, sort of up above the foliage, up there bobbing around when there's any kind of breeze. And it's the bright yellow center, very dramatic. We answer a lot of questions about this plant every year when it comes into bloom. When people see them 3 to 4 foot on the hillsides and they decide to plant them in their native plant garden in Davis, we have rich soil. We have soil that holds nutrients and water. They thrive here once established. It can be a little tricky to get them established. This is a common complaint on native plant groups is that I planted it and it died. Yeah, you just got to keep trying. But let me tell you, once you get it established, it will spread freely. It spreads by, I think they're technically rhizomes. Yes, underground rhizomes. Even the Western Garden Book describes it as invasive, don't plant near less vigorous plants, tolerates varying soils, yeah, that's for sure, withholds summer irrigation to keep growth in check. You notice a pattern here. Cut nearly to ground in late fall. Well, sure, you don't actually have to do that, but it, I guess, would look more tidy and orderly if you were to do that. And the new shoots emerge after the first rains in the winter. Although they're easy to grow once established, very difficult to propagate. And that's true. For a long time, I could never get Matilla hop poppy in my nursery. Nobody would grow it. People and growers would tell me they would try and root cuttings. They wouldn't root. It didn't come up from seed. The only way to increase it was by dividing the rhizomes. Somewhere along the line, 10 or 15 years ago, a couple of my growers somehow cracked the secret for how to grow Matilla hop poppy, and they will typically have one or two crops each year, crops of container plants of it available at some point. It's a fussy one for nursery growers. It's one that rots in the pots a lot, and they don't root readily, so it can be challenging to get a nice-looking saleable plant, which, just for the record, is a big problem we have.
So it's going to be expensive.
Well, a lot of California natives don't present themselves well in containers. They don't have that kind of eye appeal where they're a compact plant with blooms on them. No, it's not going to do that. It's just going to be a leafy thing and can be a little sparse looking. They're pricey because it takes them a lot longer to get a saleable plant, and they have a lower take rate, you might say, from division. But once you get it going in your yard, it will spread freely. I remember a customer years ago who had he bought the lot behind him when he built his house. And the lot behind him in the 1980s, he planted completely in native plants. It was a very cool landscape, very interesting, very much ahead of his time. And so he had all these things, the Fremont Adendrons and the Ceanothus, the coastal natives, the Southern California natives. He planted a couple of Matilla hop poppies in one zone that was sort of at the downward slope where water tended to drain towards, but then past in the wintertime. And it was, by the time I got there a few years later, a 30-foot bed, about 6 feet deep, solid Matilla hop poppy. So this is a plant that needs to be in a large bed, deep bed, someplace where it has enough room to spread and that won't bother you. So where it won't say spread under the fence or something like that and perhaps bother your neighbors. This isn't bamboo or anything, but it is a vigorous plant. I want you to understand that when you plant it. And it's a fairly coarse looking plant. The leaves are sort of not tidy and attractive. So you put it in the back behind these other interesting things you have that it will slowly engulf, and just enjoy this bloom for about a 6 week period in the spring. It'll take slopes. Drainage is important to a degree. You don't want water standing around it. Other than that, not a fussy plant in general.
Yeah. And the thing about slopes, that's the one thing I've heard about Matilla hop poppy is that you don't want to plant it flat. You want to plant it someplace where water's going to run past it instead of sitting on it.
This is something that's hard to explain to people what we mean by good drainage and why we're concerned about it. But there are many plants that I've planted on my property where I have good draining soil. I have a silty loam that drains very well. And I'll plant them and they'll do fine. Then we'll have a very wet winter, or particularly late winter, early spring, like March, we'll have a very high rainfall spell. March 1995, we had 10 inches of rain.
And then it warms up.
Not 10 inches of rain in that year, okay? And so one half of my asparagus bed, as it's getting warmer, so the soil temperature is increasing, pathogens can get in. Half of my asparagus bed died out. It was the part that was down ground level. The part that was up, that sloped down to that, still there. Years later, still doing fine. So this is when it really matters, is when you're getting towards warmer soil temperatures and high moisture status, and excess water doesn't percolate away. And I would think that could be a little bit of a problem with Matilla hop poppy. Getting it established is usually the tricky part. Within a year or two, you know whether it's going to go, and then it goes. As they say, with respect to bamboo, the old phrase is, first it sleeps, then it creeps, and then it leaps.
This is from Kenneth. Dear Lois and Don, per your advice, I have waited until now to plant my tomato plants. However, Mother Nature either did not hear your show or did not listen to your advice. These, and there are three pictures, are tomato plant volunteers that started growing in January.
Yes.
I don't know what type they are. Do you think it's because of the unusual weather we've had this year? And he shows pictures of three plants that they do look like tomato plants.
They are tomato plants.
I don't see any flowers or anything, but the leaves look right.
Yeah, he's in a coastal zone, Palo Alto. This happened. My father would have seedling tomatoes come up all the time. Just for the record, the volunteers were almost always a cherry type is what they would become. If you're planting F1 hybrid tomatoes, as most people are, the seedlings will not come true, as we say, from seed. They will be tomatoes and they're perfectly edible, but typically my experience is they're usually about a 2 to 3 ounce round red tomato. So that appears to be sort of what they back cross to, or what they revert to. Yes, it's because of the unusual weather we've had this year. We had warm, sunny spells, especially in coastal California. This is important for people listening locally in Davis. When we were mired under gloomy 43-degree fog for 4 weeks or whatever it was, literally 5 weeks when the temperature barely got even to 50, mostly in the mid-40s here, all of November and in, you know, all of mid to late November and into December, the rest of the state was sunnier than usual. The rest of the state was lovely. We were sitting down here shivering in this cold fog, and they were, yeah, it's 55, 60 degrees here in the Central California. Wow, that's it. Look, 70 degrees in Southern California. I was actually concerned if you all would get enough chilling hours for your fruit trees, whereas we got all the chilling hours we needed by the middle of December this year. So it is very likely that you were sunnier and warmer than would be typical. Obviously, the seeds came up. Obviously, they got off to a good start, and that does look like a good microclimate. If you're in coastal zones, you can plant tomatoes a lot earlier than what we talk about on here in some cases, but you do get down cold enough to kind of set them back. One thing I'll say, they get off to a good start. They can weather, to use the term, bad weather pretty readily and come back from it. And I would think that those seedlings will probably grow great and give you fruit that might be good, probably be good enough anyway. It's not going to be anything spectacular typically. I enjoy letting seedling tomatoes grow and see what you get. As I say, typically it's like a large 2 to 3 ounce cherry tomato. That's the most common, but who knows? You might get a unique, unusual new cultivar that you can name and put on the market. The Brad Gates Wild Boar Farms line, for example, which you can find at nurseries in the Bay Area and our nursery in places like ours in Sacramento Valley, they're all seedlings that he found. He grows seedlings from heirloom tomatoes. He was a farmer who sells tomatoes to high-end restaurants, and he wants really fancy, beautiful, interesting tomatoes. And out of every 100 of a particular variety of heirloom that he would plant, heirlooms usually come true from seed, but out of every 100, 3, 4, 5 will be different. There's just seedling variation. Most of the rest are true enough to type to be sold as that whatever. If these seedlings are unique in some way, different striping, different color, bigger, smaller fruit, more productive, ripens earlier, ripens later, ripens longer, any of a number of criteria that he would use, he would see if those characteristics come true to the next generation and the next, and he would grow them out. He does this, he still does this, 4 or 5 generations to make sure they're consistent so that most of the 100 seeds you plant will be just like what he's now calling it. And he has a new variety. It's a new variety based on old heirlooms. So seedlings can be good. They can be like the parent in the case of seedlings from an heirloom. They will not be like the parent in the case of seedlings from a hybrid, but they might be great, or they might just be interesting 2 ounce red tomato. I would leave them for fun. My guess is, yes, you guys had great weather for getting tomatoes off to a good start back there in the mid to late winter. You got cold again like we did, but those plants were evidently well established enough. It looks like they're going to come on through and give you plenty of fruit later this summer.
So Catherine from Davis writes, "Hello, I love my bay tree, but I don't want to turn it into a grove. So I religiously pull seedlings and remove suckers. I recently read somewhere that if I cut off suckers, it will cause more to sprout so that they should be ripped out." Oh, wait a minute. Suckers are coming from the root. If you rip out the root, you've
technically, yeah, we'll go on.
Okay. This is fine with the little ones, but does not work well with the ones I didn't notice for a while. I'm hoping to hear that what I read was wrong, and I'll do whatever you say.
Well,
you.
If you cut off a bay tree, Laurus nobilis, we're talking about not the California bay, Umbilularia californica. We're talking about the Mediterranean or Grecian bay laurel, Laurus nobilis. One is, there's a chance that you have a female. They are dioecious, and you have male and female trees in the case of the bay laurel. And if you get the female, after a decade or so, they start fruiting and they do reseed quite a bit. The seedlings look kind of like privets. Once you have a tree, you'll have a lot of little seedlings. You should
seedlings, you can pull them out because the roots are separate.
Yeah.
A sucker is actually from the existing tree, right?
It's either coming from the stem right at the base or coming from the roots near the base. And those root suckers, if you cut them off, they'll definitely resprout. There's no question. They've got the whole strength of that giant tree behind them to get them to regrow. And as we've talked about when we're talking about pruning hedges and the, you know, rejuvenation pruning on evergreen plants, bay laurels have buds ready to grow all the way down to the ground. If you take a chainsaw and cut down a 40-foot tall bay tree, it will resprout. In fact, a whole bunch of shoots will resprout. It'll have quite an extensive root system to support those new sprouting, I guess we'll call them suckers at that point. So bay trees can become a little invasive locally. And since they've been widely planted in Davis for 50, 60 years, in older neighborhoods, there's a good chance you'll have bay trees coming up on their own. If you get them the first season, the first summer, and boy, do I have a lot of experience with this with tree weeds on my property. If you get them in the first summer, either dig them out or even cut them off the first season, they'll usually die. If they go to the second year, those seedlings will become very persistent, very hard to get rid of. So religiously pulling the seedlings is actually very productive. The suckers, you cut them off, they're just going to resprout. But the only thing you could do to keep them from resprouting would be to excavate around them all the way down to the root from which they are sprouting and just cut them off, cut that portion of the root system off. No, that will definitely not hurt the bay tree. I guarantee it won't be a problem at all as far as that goes. But that's the only way to get that part of the plant not to resprout. And my best guess is that where you cut it, it'll probably sprout again at some point in a year or two. You've just basically delayed the process. So you do have to keep after them. It's best to go down under the point you cut to before. Because what happens in a lot of cases, I see this especially when things are suckering in a lawn and they just get mowed off over and over and they callus over and you get this gall-like thing down at the ground level. It's got all these growth buds ready to keep resprouting because you're continuously top pruning it, but not removing it. So we can get down removing.
Yeah,
you're essentially pollarding a little.
Pollarding.
Well, I wouldn't, yes, technically, I'm not sure that would apply, but it's the same principle. You're cutting it back as resprouting from the same point year after year after year. So you'll get ahead of it a little bit. If you just excavate a little, I've found that a narrow folding saw works particularly well for this, and just cut that whole unit off, and that'll give you a two-year head start before you'll have to do it again. Bay trees are persistent, vigorous. We got a lot of reasons for planting them. They're great trees for a lot of purposes. They get a lot bigger than most people realize. There's one on Plum Lane that was 50 feet tall. It was planted in the 1940s. Had a customer near the campus who wanted to screen his neighbors in one of those little houses near the campus. He bought 12 of them. They did such a great job. He bought 10 more. So his yard, surrounded by fraternities and whatnot, is essentially a wall of bay laurel. Well, it is a very manageable screen because even if it starts getting tall and maybe thinning out down at the base, so you're now seeing through it and you see your neighbors, you can just cut it down. It'll resprout. It's like privet in that regard. You can turn it back into whatever hedge of whatever height you want. So it is a very manageable plant in that regard. Heat tolerant, Mediterranean plant, drought tolerant, great choice in this area. A little side note, people often ask, well, how about the California bay laurel? Can we plant the native one? You may have trouble finding that. It's a host to sudden oak death, which is a disease on the coast, strictly on the coastal zone, Sunset Zone 17, but it's a well-known host for that plant, that particular disease. And nurseries in the coastal areas just stopped growing it completely back when sudden oak death hit about 20 years ago. And so I used to stock both kinds. I would stock Mediterranean Bay and I would stock Umbellularia because some people wanted the native one. Grew more slowly, but a very nice plant in its place. Lovely aroma. I really like it, but I simply couldn't get it. And it became a concern with respect to sudden oak death. So if you're interested in the California Bay Umbellularia, you may have difficulty locating that one. Laurus nobilis, not a problem. Grows very readily. It is a case where nobody has really separated male and female trees. It would be really handy in the nursery industry with this particular plant if people would propagate male bay laurel and sell them so people wouldn't have the seedling trees coming up in their yard. There's one exception to that, the Saratoga Bay, which is a hybrid bay, and that one is a male cultivar. It's not a cultivar of Laurus nobilis. This is a hybrid between two other species, but it has proven to be a great garden plant. More rounded head, so more of a tree-like appearance, bigger leaf, kind of a lusher appearance, and a male tree, so you don't have reseeding babies all over your yard. So Saratoga Bay is a good option if you want to get away from that issue with the reseeding problem, but it also has a broader canopy. And one of the things people really like about the Laurus nobilis is that strongly upright growth habit. Fits in a lot of yards in spite of how big it gets.
Okay, so if someone who shall remain nameless planted one of these trees, mm-hmm. not really understanding about it at that time, and it grew, but it was getting too big and it was in the wrong place and she cut it down. Mm-hmm. And so I cut it down and then I put that kill the stump mm-hmm. Bottled stuff on mm-hmm. it. didn't work.
It has a lot of buds.
And below that, things just kept coming out,
yeah,
coming
it will.
Out, coming out, and coming out. Now, if I were to actually get rid of the central trunk, you know, actually chop it out, would all of the roots sprout?
No, some might here and there, but generally speaking, when people cut down bay trees and then have the stump ground out or whatever, that usually is the end of it. That's not a big problem. Seedlings may continue to come up for quite a while because
we don't have seedlings.
Yeah, you have a male tree, unfortunately. Yeah, so some of it might pop up here and there, but very unlikely for it to be a major, major problem. And the chemical you're talking about, vine and stump killer, it's triclopyr. It's usually painted right on the cambium itself. Plants that have a lot of dormant buds, like privets, like bay trees, like coast redwoods, things like that. It's generally a 2 to 3 year process of killing them out if you want to. Here's the other thing about bay laurel. You can manage it at any height you want, but I've seen bay laurel kept as a plant in a 14 inch pot for a decade just because someone wanted it for the leaves for cooking and they liked the way it looked. And it's a classic one for that kind of use. You can clip them very formally if you happen to like that look. So it's something that you can grow in a pot. You can put it in the ground, prune it like a shrub. If you do nothing, it'll turn into a very big upright tree. And then if you decide that's too tall, it is one case where heading it back, you know, we tell you never use heading cuts. You can do it on bay laurel. You can take it up there on that 15-foot bay tree. You can get up on your ladder, bring it down to 8 feet. It'll sprout right back out and look fine very quickly. It's a wonderful plant. And there is one pest that people should be aware of. It's more of a problem in the Bay Area than in the Valley. It's a psyllid. P-S-Y-L-L-I-D, psyllid, the P is silent, which is sort of an aphid relative that gets on the new growth, the tender new growth only, and causes it to buckle and get distorted. And it's a common problem where it's being grown as a hedge because you have this constant supply of new growth. So if you're hedging your bay laurel and you're in the Bay Area, you probably will see the psyllid at some point. In the Valley, it's a very short-lived phenomenon. The plant tends to outgrow it. And of course, if you're growing them more naturally, it's simply not a problem. So that's just one thing to be aware of, since I have to answer that question every so often. I have had this psyllid on my bay tree, and I barely notice it. But if I were pruning it as a hedge, you would notice it because all the new growth at some point might be distorted by that.
Wants to talk about dahlia.
Dahlias. Yes, we discovered this lovely little nursery up in Oregon that is just a dahlia specialist. And one of the really cool things about being in this industry is that you get people who become obsessed, fascinated, experts on a particular plant, and they start growing them until they have way too many. And then they sell them locally, and they still have way too many. And someone says, maybe you should sell these to other nurseries. So they contacted us this winter, and we went ahead and ordered some of their dahlias, which are beautiful, beautiful tubers. Tuberous roots, technically, is what you're dealing with a dahlia. And one of the most common questions I get here is, do dahlias grow here? I didn't know you could grow them here. We hear that about a lot of big flowered plants that are more traditionally associated with other regions. Dahlias do grow great here. They're actually quite easy to grow. This is one case where the Western Garden Book disturbs me a little bit. With certain groups of plants, where there are established societies, there is a dahlia society, a rose society, a chrysanthemum society, they just kind of handed it off to those societies to write the part in the Western Garden Book about how to grow this group of plants. So this is one of the reasons people think chrysanthemums, roses, dahlias are fussy, because there's these checklists of things you're supposed to do if you're going to grow them. There's all these groups, these categories. It's another flower for which there is a long established tradition of shows, blue ribbons, competitions, giant flowers, and all that kind of stuff. That can be fun if you're into that kind of thing. But I don't want you to think you have to do that for roses, or chrysanthemums, or dahlias, or any of the other kinds of plants where if you look in your Western Garden Book, it clearly was written by people who are really mildly obsessed with these plants. Dahlias do grow in the Valley. They also grow in Fort Bragg. Ours, not the one back east. So what's the difference there? Well, our average temperature in July is 93 degrees. Average temperature in Fort Bragg in July, I think, is 63 degrees. And they do equally well in both places. In the Fort Bragg, with the Mendocino Coast Botanical Gardens, if you get over there, August, September, it's worth driving all the way there just to see a dahlia garden at least once in your lifetime. Hundreds of dahlias in full bloom in the sort of open lawn area with a pavilion nearby. You'll spend an hour or two just taking pictures because they're utterly amazing. So you're thinking, how can these plants also grow in the 5% humidity, 95 degree Sacramento Valley? Well, they do, as long as we give them plenty of water. In Fort Bragg, they're in full sun. In this climate, my experience has been light afternoon shade is helpful. Full sun in the morning, even to 2 or 3 in the afternoon is fine. But when you get into the 4, 5, 6 o'clock sun, when it's 100 and something degrees, it's very common for the leaves to scorch. This is a plant, like many of these plants that are subject to competitions and shows and things like that, that does respond to pampering. You want to have fun? Just get one dahlia tuberous root, plant it in a big barrel, give it as much water and fertilizer as you think it can stand, and you will get spectacular results. You'll get 30 blooms that are as big as a dinner plate on a plant that's 4 by 4. That's what they will do if you give them all of that care. But you know, they'll also bloom very nice if you don't do all of that. So you can just stick them in the ground, in the garden someplace where it drains reasonably well. That's the most important thing. They're a little vulnerable to rot. And stake them somehow. This is a plant where those little tomato cages, they work great. The kind of thing you would use to stabilize a peony would work great because they are big, upright, vigorous, lush plants that sprawl if they don't have something holding them upright. They look okay if they sprawl, but a little messy. So not a bad idea to put some kind of a short cage on them early on in the growth cycle. You might even want to stake some of the bigger ones because we are talking about potentially blooms anywhere from 6 to as much as 12 inches across, giant blooms on the dinner plate dahlias and some of the cactus dahlias. And then you'll have these amazing blooms starting in July and in through August and even as late as September. My experience here is if they get any drought stress at all, the leaves will look terrible. And that sometime about early to mid-August, you're likely to get thrips or spider mites, making the leaves look pretty unsightly. That really bothered me when I first planted dahlias here because they looked really rough after that big cycle of bloom and maybe the second bloom, they would look really rough after a heat wave. And I'd look closely and there were bugs on the leaves. What do? Do I run down to the garden center and buy the most lethal cocktail of pesticides I possibly can? No. One dahlia grower said, just cut them back. Do what? Just cut them back 50%. Just go ahead. They look rough. Just go ahead. Do it to your marigolds too. They get the same problems. They've done that big peak of bloom. Don't just deadhead them. Take them back 50%. Take all that stuff. Throw it away. Wash the plant off. Feed it again. It loves to be fed. Keep it watered. It'll flush right back out and give you another bloom. And from that, I learned that you can get a spectacular bloom on your dahlias and your marigolds in late summer and fall if you cut them back when they look rough in midsummer. So that's my special tip for growing dahlias. Now is when we plant them. We don't even think about putting them in the ground until the soil is warm enough for peppers, eggplant, and okra. That's when you plant your dahlias. These are plants from Mexico and Guatemala. They want warm soil, warm summer conditions. Pamper them if you want. It can be lots of fun, but you don't absolutely have to do that. Having said all that about big regular dahlias, every nursery is going to have little bedding dahlias, little 6-packs, little 4-inch pots, quart pots of dahlias that grow to 1 to 2 feet. Tight clusters of smaller flowers, really hot colors on these. These are generally hot pink, orange, red, also more pastel shades if you're into that kind of thing. On plants that don't need any staking, don't need any special attention, and don't seem to be as susceptible to thrips and spider mite problems. So they're great garden plants and they exist and they're fun to grow if you want those strong daisy colors. But big dahlias are worth growing at least once in your life for something, for a flower bigger than your face, why not?
So I want to ask you about clematis. Is mm-hmm. this the time to plant clematis or not?
You can plant them anytime. It's the time when they're beginning to bloom spectacularly. My purple clematis jackmannii has about 100 blooms on it right now, and it's just getting going. So this is when they're really blooming, and a lot of nurseries do like to feature them at this time of year. It's interesting how long it takes to grow a clematis vine to be saleable to the public in bloom. It actually takes 2 full years, has been my experience, to grow a 5-gallon clematis, so they're not cheap. Sometimes you can find them in a 1-gallon, and that's a great way to go, because really what you're buying with a clematis is the root system. When you plant one that's in bloom, it's not going to grow a whole lot more this year. The way they actually grow is it's an herbaceous perennial that dies essentially to the ground. I mean, it's a woody plant, but essentially the whole top grows up and blooms and is done. This is the jackmannii hybrids, the most common ones. And when it's all done, you can pull it down and cut it back at the end of the season. But the main thing is it does all the growth before the bloom, typically. As my jackmannii plant, which is now 30, 35, 40 years old, I can't even remember when I planted it. It has a root clump that's 3 feet across. So if I were to dig this up, it would fill a barrel. And another little piece of it has come up about 3 feet away. So apparently it has multiplied itself somehow. It's completely gone in the winter. I mean, there's deciduously dead stuff in the tree. And I just pull it all down and cut it off. And sometime around mid to late February, 1st of March, I notice, oh, the clematis is popping up. I better decide where it's going to go this year, because it's going to grow 15 feet in about 6 weeks. And it's going to scramble up on whatever is nearby. One year I let it grow over an entire Sarcococca hedge. It was spectacular. I let it climb up into a Japanese maple. More recently, I've gotten more moderate and I put a tomato cage on it. But I mean a 6 foot tomato cage. Completely fills that, cascades back down to the ground, then bloom. So it's turned out to be a really good way to grow clematis. If you're looking for a way to contain them and make them spectacular, a 6 foot tomato cage did a great job for me, and it's still out there looking very good 2 to 3 years in. Something to determine where it's going to grow and then have that massive bloom. A trellis is fine. Climbing on a rose bush is fine. Those all work. There are summer blooming types. There are even fall blooming types. So once you really get into them, you'll start planting more kinds of clematis to get a longer season of bloom. They want to be planted in the shade. Whether they'll grow up into the sun, fine, but they need to be planted in the shade. That's been my experience. This plant that I have is in direct sun for 2 to 3 hours in the morning. It was in a lot more sun when I planted it, but once again, that bed, you know, fills up with trees, and it grows up, scrambles up into a sunny spot and blooms up there. So that's their natural growth habit. Even our native ones, and there's 2 or 3 species of native clematis up around Berryessa. You'll sometimes find them if you're hiking out in the countryside there. They grow under a shrub. They come up with the first rains. In the case of our native ones, they scramble up to the top of the shrub. They cover over the top completely. They bloom while it's still towards the end of the rainy season. They set seed, which is fluffy and kind of pretty in its own right. It is carried off by the wind to catch on a nearby shrub, fall down to the ground, get covered with leaf litter from that shrub. That's ideal. And that leaf litter from the shrub is a key trick with clematis. Mulching them makes a huge difference. Even moisture is important, but they don't need special moisture. They just need even moisture, which means mulching to help retain moisture when you apply it. Really quite easy to grow. A little pricey at first, but something that will give you many, many, many years of reward.
Well, you know, this is spring, and a lot of folks think that spring is the time you get wildflowers. So
they're blooming.
Yeah, they're blooming. You can see them. It's like, ooh, that would be pretty. And so Don had 3 different people come into his store last week looking for wildflower seeds. Now, as one guy said, he wants to just throw them out and get a whole yard of flowers.
Yeah.
And that's not exactly what's going to happen.
Well, you could, as long as you throw a few qualifiers in there. Sure, just throw them out at the right time of year and give them the proper aftercare and keep the weeds under control and get a whole yard of flowers, because you allow them to reseed and naturalize and cover over a 2 to 3 year period. He has a neighbor, or there's someone had a visible garden, I can't remember, and there's some up around town right now that look great, that have lots of California poppies blooming. That's what everybody notices, because you can't miss the color. It's bright orange. But there's lots of other things blooming in this particular yard I'm thinking of, on a corner of 8th and L, for example. There's 3 yards right next to each other that have a couple different kinds of poppies, including California poppies and other flowering things, including some wildflowers. And I know that that particular garden, the gardener who's been managing it for the last couple of decades, has allowed things to reseed, has planted new things, has added seed at different times. So there is some follow-up care needed. More to the point,
and gotten rid of the weeds. That's
the
weird.
The weirds or the weeds?
The weeds.
Well, the weirds too. Usually some one plant's going to start to dominate. You better decide whether you actually want that to be the case. He was hoping that you could just buy mixes of wildflower seeds, and someone else basically the same thing. Clearly, you know, not gardeners, but this looks like an easy way to go. It isn't as easy as you might think. However, the main thing is, if you see them blooming now, it's probably not the right time to plant the seed. Wherever you're listening, you would plant the seed perhaps at the time nature would plant the seed. So when it's all finishing bloom and making seed pods, and then those seed pods are bursting and scattering the seed, that's one thought, is to do it at that time, which in the case of California poppies, for example, would be June, July, that those seed pods are bursting, scattering their seed, which will then lie there until the winter rains come. Fall and winter rains will cause the seedlings to germinate. Then you either move them around or thin them out or just let them do their thing naturally. But you've followed nature's pattern as to when to plant the seed. Or you can go out in the fall right before the rains and scatter the seed. And you might get good results depending on what the wildflower seeds are and what's on the ground. If it's bare dirt, poppies will probably do great, especially if you put them down right before a rainstorm or even during a rainstorm. Great thing to do when it's raining in the fall or even into the midwinter. Even in late winter, you still have time. So we end up having this conversation. What would happen if I plant them now? Well, poppy seeds will probably just lie there, hopefully, if they don't get eaten by birds or something, and wait to germinate until they get the fall rains. And they will germinate if they're in the open, not covered. That's really important for poppy seeds. If they're covered, if there's leafy debris or weeds or something there, that seed will just lie there and wait to be uncovered. 10 years, 20 years, whatever it takes, a fire, goats coming through, something mowing it, suddenly they come up. The seed does last a long time, but it won't germinate in the absence of light. So this is a particular case where it has to be on bare soil. Other seeds that you scatter in the spring may just rot, disappear, blow away before they get to the proper season for germination. Poppy seeds are pretty hard. Lupin seeds are pretty hard, would probably stick around, but a lot of other things simply wouldn't do well. So you'll get more for your money, you'll get better results if you get the area all prepped and then plant in the fall as the rains are beginning. The other question I would typically have for someone who's a little more advanced gardener is, what are the weeds that are on the site already? Because those may become such a hassle. You know, if it's good conditions for wildflowers to germinate and grow, it's good conditions for weeds to germinate and grow. And differentiating between those two is a challenge for a novice gardener. A lot of grasses are going to come up, and that's just they're going to choke out your wildflowers if that's what's there right now. So this is a good time now to strategize for fall planting of wildflowers, because you know what the weeds are. You know what you're going to do as we go through the summer. Get your seed midsummer to early fall and be ready when the rains come in next year.
So in nature, if we lived in California, which we do, and you go out and you see, you know, fields full of wildflowers, and they're not anything that anyone is cultivating, they're just there. Mm-hmm. Well, they're spring blooming, and that's because it rains in the winter, and so mm-hmm. they can grow and they can bloom. But in the summer, when it's hot and dry, they're probably going to go away.
Here in the valley, yeah.
Is that what you try and imitate in your garden? Do you not water?
If you tolerate that, I have an area that's a lot of native grass, and it's bare dirt in the summertime. And so you need to understand that we don't have a lot here in the valley. We don't have a lot of California natives that are going to bloom right on through the summer. But there's one exception, which is the narrow-leafed milkweed, Asclepias fascicularis. And I do have a stand of that out in that area of native grasses, which comes into bloom midsummer and attracts all kinds of things. It's notable for the monarchs, but it's also attractive to many other things. So you'll have to go out of your way a little bit to get summer plants in there that are blooming. If you're not that concerned about that, this is a valley grassland plant community where we are here. You can get certain native grasses like deer grass, you know, big, bold grass, very dramatic, 3x3 easily, 4x4 is not uncommon. It looks great in the summer. If it's irrigated, it looks better, but if it's not irrigated, it makes it through just fine. So you can have plants out there, but that's where those woody plants help out, because if you just want a whole area of wildflowers, things are going to be a little bare in the Central Valley in the summertime. Getting in some perennials like the milkweed, getting in some woody plants that at least have interesting foliage would be the way to get seasonal color, where you're trying to focus on things here for the Central Valley. The best resource on all this, calscape.org, calscape, CalScape, Project of the California Native Plant Society. Just type in your zip code, click on perennials or annuals, and that's your good starting point. Then you do need to ask, if you're a novice gardener, particularly about the annuals, is there anything special that those seeds require in order to get them going? Seeds can be surprisingly expensive. California wildflower seeds are not cheap, because these are harvested very carefully and they maintain species purity. So you're going to pay more for them. So let's do this right. If you're going to go to a native wildflower mix combined with native plants or appropriate climate ready plants to get nice seasonal color and draw beneficials, do a little research first. Generally, those types of things, fall to early winter is the best time for planting in this area. They're seeing them blooming now because people planted them last year in late summer, fall, or early winter.
So another person came in and was talking about wildflowers and said, so I have a drip system. Will that work for this? Tell me, Don, is a drip system good for wildflowers?
Once they're germinated and growing, yeah. It won't start them, because they need overhead water typically to get to germinate. Rainfall is ideal, but yes.
Well, if you plant in the fall, you'll hopefully have rainfall.
Yeah, plant in the fall, overhead water them. Then your drip system is a great way to get them going as soon as they germinate, and it will work fine. Generally speaking, these are plants that germinate with rains, grow through the rainy period, finish up when the rainy period is over. So they don't really need irrigation typically. You can extend the season. Anyone who's grown California poppies, for example, has had the experience of a plant blooming right on into the summer. They are functionally short-lived perennials in the valley. A plant that you plant, I learned this years ago from a guy who spent much of his career as superintendent of the Arboretum. If you take this California poppy and it's sprawled out and it looks like it's done blooming and you gather it together and you cut it off about 4 to 6 inches above the ground, take all that stuff away, those seed pods you can throw somewhere else and let them split and scatter. That plant you just cut back, my experience with this, will typically come back, sprout up again, give another bloom. When Caltrans mows along the freeway near us here, maybe mow the grasses in May to June, the poppies that are in there often pop up and give another bloom into June or even July because their roots have gone deep. So it depends on how much rainfall we got during the winter, but late season rains will keep them going further on in. So they can function as a perennial. And then, of course, they also naturalize by reseeding.
So do wildflowers typically have very, very shallow roots? Because one of these people said, well, there's going to be brick underneath some of the dirt.
That's not going to be great unless the bricks have gaps and the roots can get between them. No, in fact, California poppies are a good example. We have tried various ways of growing things like poppies for sale at our nursery and lupins. They're both very challenging. And you can tell why. You plant the seed, it makes a taproot right away. Goes straight down to the bottom of whatever you're growing again, hits the bottom, and either the tip dies in the case of poppies, in which case you now have a plant that's somewhat stunted, or they start circling, particularly in the case of the lupins. Now you have a plant that gets very root bound very quickly. These are not plants that lend themselves to nursery production, let me tell you. Aside from the special germination requirements that the lupins happen to have, getting them to a saleable looking plant in a 3 or 4 inch pot is really challenging because by the time they have two true leaves, their roots are circling the bottom and they're trying to get out. So they're really better to germinate them, plant them out as quickly as you can. They don't hold well in containers. So those two in particular appear to have tap roots that are actually pretty problematic from a nursery standpoint. A lot of the daisies and things like that, I mentioned the Medea, for example, you'll see that growing where there's very shallow soil. It grows, it flowers a foot tall. Even the rich soil is 4 feet tall. So it just depends on what it has available to it. That also determines how long into the season it keeps growing, blooming, and seeding. But it, like most daisies, this is true of sunflowers and a lot of others. If it's got what it needs for even a brief period, it will zoom to bloom, go to seed as fast as it can, and spread itself. So people driving across the United States, these are some of my favorite books from the past, travelogues from before the interstate freeways went in. They drive that long stretch through Kansas, Nebraska, and Oklahoma, where sunflowers are native and where they're from. And they would observe as they went from the wetter side to the drier side of the country, just as many sunflowers blooming, but shorter and shorter and shorter and shorter as they went along. So you cross that 100th meridian, which is basically the rainfall line of the United States. If they got rain into the summer steadily, you get great big fields of these beautiful sunflowers. And an hour further down the road, they'd only be 4 feet tall. Then they'd be 2 feet tall, but they'd still be blooming and going to seed because they're going to make the best of whatever soil moisture and season they have.
Vegetable varieties suggested for 2026.
So there's a lot of tomatoes out there. If you're just trying to figure out a half dozen for your own garden, some that did really well for me last year is what this is. Jetstar, which was a new one to me. I'll be doing it for a second year this year. Carmelo, I've mentioned that a couple times. It's an old variety that performed extremely well last year. Champion, you know, if you're going to have one reliable red tomato that's going to produce all the way to the end of the season, Champion is very aptly named. I've planted them as late as July and had good results from them. Planting it early, you will be picking from Champion pretty much all season. And when I've observed for things like, does it set during the heat? Does it ripen late? It does both of those things. So although not when it's 100 and something degrees, it still sets into the low 90s. And that means you'll have a reasonably good supply of tomatoes all through the season. I also mentioned Rugby. That's kind of unique to us because not many other growers know that one. There's a new version of San Marzano called Marzanera, which I think you all who like San Marzano would like. So those are some that would be just reliable. And I do suggest if you're looking for conventional red tomatoes, These new ones with the so-called stacked genes, where they've bred in greater resistance to various diseases and in some cases slightly tighter growth habit. Two of them in particular have done very well: Early Girl Bush and Celebrity Plus. If you like Celebrity, I think Celebrity Plus is better. It's got a better growth habit and it's got some disease resistance built in. These are not genetically modified. I was talking to someone about this. They wanted to know if these have genes inserted into them. No, conventional breeding, stacking genes that provide resistance to particular leaf diseases, enhanced resistance to certain soil diseases. Early Girl Bush appears to be just as good as Early Girl and has this added disease resistance as well. I would mention, I'm shifting over to New Girl. I'll do it once again this year where I plant Early Girl and New Girl side by side, but for the last 2 years, New Girl has won that competition. So that's enough about tomatoes. There's loads to choose from. I always suggest you try something different, something unusual, as well as some tried and true varieties. With respect to peppers, because we get a lot of questions about bell peppers, they are a hassle. Let's just leave it at that. Bell peppers, they get sunburn. They just aren't as easy to grow as all these other sweet peppers like Marconi, Gypsy, Jimmy Nardello, and people just love shishito peppers these days. So for among the sweet peppers, those are all good choices. Hot peppers, the ones you know, are great choices here. Jalapeno, Fresno, Serrano, all do very well here. If you're into hot peppers, try some of the aji peppers. You'll find them at some nurseries. If you like the super hots, the key with those is don't even plant them until the soil is much warmer. If you like habanero, Carolina Reaper, Trinidad Scorpion, Butjolkia, any of these just insanely hot peppers, you don't plant them until Memorial Day, because if they go into cold soil, they will struggle all season. So if you happen to like those types, wait till later. The cucumbers, I just want to mention, lemon is always my best producer and I love it, but not everybody likes it. Summer Dance, great performance, no mildew. So that was a good one for me this year. Tasty King, Persian Little Fingers, and Unagi. That's a white one that's really cool and interesting. Just that's enough about vegetables. I would like to do this every week or so because some of you are out buying now. Some of you are making notes for later. So those are a few that have done well for me. And again, with respect to basil, the Emerald Towers is just amazing, all of us, with its performance. Long yield, goes all the way into the fall with no problem. It's a Genovese style, so a classic basil. So I would highly recommend. It's slower to get going. We've been growing it ourselves, and it grows about half as fast as regular sweet basil. But once it's in nurseries, look for that Emerald Towers Everleaf series of basil. Genovese flavor style and lasts all season. I want to do a quick shout out to the kids at Willett Elementary School, who were very welcoming to me this week. I went and spoke to 5 elementary school classes about being a nursery person and a gardener. So we're talking 6, 7, 8 years old. They were lots of fun to talk to. If you want to lift your spirits, go talk to a bunch of 6-year-olds. Seriously, all you got to do is say, who wants to have a garden this summer? Every one of them will raise their hands. Do it to a group of adults that look at each other. I don't know if we have time for a garden this year.
I don't have time.
6-year-olds. Yeah, I want a garden. It was great fun. Great to be there. Thanks a lot for having me.
And Anne Lovejoy says, gardens are as diverse as the people who make them. And I think we just proved that, didn't we?
There you go. You've been listening to the Davis Garden Show with Don Shore
and Lois Richter here at KDRT-LP 95.7 in Davis, California.